Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but...
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the glorious, wonderful Dar Williams singing the Soilotopia song with Pete Seeger and David Burns. Back here for another hour of the Soilotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk today about marijuana. The great, I'm not going to call it the evil herb, but we used to call it the evil herb just kind of joking about it back in the 60s, but I never hear that spoken of that way again, because we have medical marijuana, and marijuana is in the process of being legalized all over the country, and we're going to talk about it with the great Eric Sterling. Eric has been an advocate and an activist for legal marijuana for many, many years. I won't reveal how many unless he wants to. He is the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Silver Springs, Maryland. I've known Eric for a long, long time. We met in the mile-high town of Boulder, Colorado, many years ago. And we're going to devote the full hour to talking about pot and the legalization process of pot and what it means. And then we're also going to talk about hemp, which is actually a much bigger deal in the long run than pot in terms of gross income and impact on our post-industrial economy. Eric, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Harvey. How are you?
I'm great, man. I'm great to hear. Great to hear your voice. It's wonderful. I had an opening. I was wondering how it was going to be filled, and just as I was thinking that, I got an email from you reminding us that we have promised to talk again on the, and this is the perfect moment to talk to you about pot and about the legalization process. We have something to celebrate. Just this past week, Puerto Rico has legalized medical marijuana. You want to talk to us about that a bit?
Yes. The Puerto Rican situation is the most unusual situation so far. The governor, by executive order, directed the Secretary of Health to develop a medical marijuana program within 90 days. That's really extraordinary. It's not even clear that he has the constitutional power to do that. I spoke today with a top official connected with Puerto Rico to get more information and to offer my advice, because I'm a medical marijuana commissioner in Maryland. A year and a half ago, former Governor Martin O'Malley appointed me to a four-year term as a state medical marijuana commissioner to implement Maryland's medical marijuana law that has been adopted by our state legislature.
Can I ask you a personal question? Is this a paying position?
No, it's we're all citizen volunteers. It's not a paying position. We do it in addition to our regular jobs.
Okay. So it's not a day job, and you're not on the take.
I'm not on the payroll. That's correct. I get reimbursed my mileage. There's no hourly or daily per diem or anything like that.
Well, do they pay you for all the time you spend having to test medical marijuana, or is that additional?
Well, that we do, of course, just for the love of the job.
Uh-huh. All right. So now the state legislature. Well, let's finish with Puerto Rico first. How big a change is this for Puerto Rico? Is Puerto Rico really an anti-pot state? I mean, what's the deal? Territory? What's the deal?
Well, I don't know the answer about what the hostility is, but Puerto Rico is a jurisdiction. It's about 3.6 million people, and it has had a long, serious problem with unemployment and poverty, poor wages, and crime. There's been a huge crack trade. And often fears around drugs and crime spill over into hostility to marijuana, both for medicine and for recreational purposes. And so I don't know enough about all of the back and forth in Puerto Rico. There's a little bit of a sort of a constitutional crisis. The governor in his State of the Commonwealth speech was really attacking the legislature for not passing legislation he thought was critical for dealing with their funding crisis. The Puerto Rico has issued something, I think it's $70 billion in bonds. And the value of those bonds has gone down. The ability of the Commonwealth to pay them is in question. And so it has the prospect of being a much bigger bankruptcy than Detroit, which was a couple of billion dollars.
So the governor passed this medical marijuana for financial purposes?
I can't imagine that he thinks it's going to generate that kind of money. It's just not possible. I don't think, for 3.6 million people, it's not going to generate that much money. And so anyhow, that's the latest development. But you know, in New York, there was just emergency legislation introduced because New York's system is not yet up and running. Massachusetts' system is not yet operational. Illinois is not yet up to speed. It's a challenge to put together a system when you're talking about medicine that really protects health. It's such a strange situation, Harvey. You know, I've been a lawyer since 1976. I first testified for marijuana decriminalization in 1976 when I was finishing law school.
Who did you testify to?
That was before the Pennsylvania Assembly. There was a House committee in Pennsylvania looking at marijuana decriminalization a few years after the Schaefer Commission report came out, which recommended...
The Schaefer Report Commission was what?
Governor Raymond Schaefer of Pennsylvania, Republican, was named by Nixon to be the chair of the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse that was created in the 1970 drug law, which created the Controlled Substances Act and created a commission to study the nation's drug problem. And this commission, appointed by Nixon, recommended that marijuana be decriminalized in 1972.
And 1972 under Nixon?
In 1972. And about 11 states adopted marijuana decriminalization laws over the next 5 years. But we ended up by 1979 with a teenage marijuana abuse crisis. We had like 1 in 10 high school seniors getting stoned every day. And, we have, now something like 1 out of 5 high school seniors getting stoned in the last month. And many people think that's a lot. And so that situation in 1979 really laid, it was part of the political groundwork that got Reagan elected in the 1980 election. But I've been doing this since Jerry Ford was president.
And Jerry Ford, of course, was stoned all the time, which is why he fell down those airplane steps and all the other things. Sorry.
All those things.
Well, now, wait a minute, though. Why would so many kids be getting stoned then on a full-time basis and so many fewer now?
Well, for I think there's a couple of factors. One is that new drugs are very interesting. There was a very dramatic curiosity around marijuana at that point. And There was a very, very strong reaction from what had been the what we think of as the reefer madness of the 1930s and 40s. And there was a real sense, well, marijuana is not that bad. There was a tremendous explosion in the marketing of it. It was fashionable in the 70s and fell out of fashion and is in many respects still stigmatized. It's not fashionable in the same way that it was then. Drug use is a social phenomenon like how long hair is or how short skirts are or how wide neckties are. You know, why are there those kinds of changes? They're not easy to explain. It's a matter of fashion. What is fashionable? We live in an era right now that is much more competitive than it was in the 1970s. In the 70s, when we think of the 1960s, of course, we're really talking about the 70s. Woodstock was 1969. You know, it was at the end of the 60s. The period that we think of as, you know, of music festivals, of war protests, this is all taking place in the 70s. You know, Nixon is only inaugurated in January of 69. You know, so that the first half of the 70s are a time of the social protest, of the protest of the war. And Jimmy Carter is part of this reaction, you know, with, you know, his, you know, turn out the lights, let's be environmental. The first Earth Day was 1970. So that these, what we think of as the 60s culturally, really was in the 70s. And in some sense, the drug culmination of this was by 1979.
So in 1972, I vaguely remember this, kind of like I vaguely remember Woodstock. The governor of Pennsylvania, Schaefer, right? What was his first name?
Raymond Schaefer.
Raymond Schaefer had obviously a top-level commission.
It was a top-level commission.
And you testified in front of it.
No. I testified before the Pennsylvania legislature 4 years later.
Oh, okay. So, but you used it as a source material.
Correct.
And this federally sponsored high-level commission recommended that marijuana not be illegal?
That's right.
In 1972?
Yes.
So why aren't we talking about this? Why does anybody know about this study? Why has it been not revived?
Well, because we don't have historical memory. I mean, as a people, we don't think about history. You know, I mean, another way to think about it is imagine, Harvey, it's 1970, and somebody says to you, Harvey, you should look at this study that's 43 years old, that's, you know, from the late 1920s. You should look at that study in making policy. You'd say, you're crazy. What do
yeah,
I have to learn from a 40-year-old study?
I want to ask you, Eric, if you will, Eric Sterling, from the Criminal Justice Project here. Eric, I'm going to ask you to revive can you find that study and send it to me and post it back online somehow? Is there an electronic version of that
online.
Study?
It's online. It's in many places. It's been republished. I have the original volumes, but it's been published. It's easy to find. The National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse. You Google it, you can find it at the Schaefer Drug Library. It's not a buried document. It's a
Is
document.
It S-C-H-A-E-F-E-R?
It's S-C-H-A-F-E-R. Raymond
L-E.
Schaefer.
S-C-H-A-F-E-R.
Yeah.
All right. That's mind-boggling to me. I mean, I vaguely remember it, but I've been advocating legal pot for ever since then. ever since 1966, actually. And I completely blanked out on that study. I want to see that. I mean, do you think it's current? Do you think it would have resonance if we say wrote an article about it now?
It was an amazingly far-sighted study, and there were two reports. The first one was just on marijuana. The second one was on drug policy more broadly. And the second one has a great deal of wisdom. I mean, it already was warning against the danger of over-criminalization and of an anti-drug bureaucracy. And was talking about the importance of social controls. It was very concerned that we not, it really pointed us in the direction opposite the direction that we've gone. And there's, you just open it up at random and say, wow, this makes sense. Yeah, that's appropriate. That makes sense.
How many pages was this study? Was it like a 2,000-page volume or what?
No. The 1972 marijuana study would have been on the order of 150 pages, and then the 1973 report on drugs was on the order of 400 pages.
Okay, so I'm going to look this thing up. I'm going to write an article about this. If I wrote an article about this this study and put it up on the internet, would it have current value, do you think?
Yes. I when the anniversaries came up a couple years ago, I blogged about this a little bit on Huffington Post, if I recall correctly.
All right, so everybody listening, Google this Schaefer study from 1972, and I'm going to I'll write an article about it in the next couple weeks.
It's called the Schaefer Commission Report.
A Schaefer Commission Report.
Right.
Okay, when it came out, what did Nixon say? Did Nixon have Schaefer executed? I mean, what's the deal?
Well, Nixon got word that, you know, the commission report was, going to be taking these sort of moderate reformist positions.
And Schaefer was a Republican, wasn't he?
He was a Republican. He was the former governor. And there was a question of whether or not he would be named to higher office. And Nixon, from what I recall, attempted to get him to change the tenor of the report by dangling the offer of some kind of higher job. I forget if it was Supreme Court or something. And, it was just, rejected out of hand. So when the report came, the president says, I'm not going to read it.
that'll serve him right.
And the second report then didn't get much attention at all. The marijuana was the big story. The country wasn't really interested in heroin or cocaine or the other drugs, and there wasn't much of a real serious reaction to that report, which was would have greatly the 1980s would have been completely different. And so
all right, so Eric, I'm going to offer to co-write an article with you if you're game on these two reports. I mean, this is insane. This is 43 years ago. The Republican governor or ex-governor of Pennsylvania comes out in a federal study and says that marijuana should be decriminalized, and here it is 43 years later, and we're still busting people for pot? Give me a break.
Right. It's crazy. It's crazy. But we
I am reading it. We'll get back to specifics. I want to talk to you about what's happening in Maryland, where you're an official or a semi-official, and also what's going to happen in Ohio this fall, which is very interesting. But I'm reading an astonishing book, one of the most depressing books I've ever read, actually, called The New Jim Crow.
Michelle Alexander.
What's that?
Michelle Alexander.
Yes, and Michelle Alexander is a professor at Ohio State across town here from me. And this book, I'm about two-thirds of the way through. You know, you got to put it down. I mean, from time to time, this book outlines why we still have a drug war, which was shown to be insane, as you're saying, way back in 1972. And basically, it's all about the repression of black people. It doesn't have anything to do with public health. It doesn't have anything to do with saving our youth. It's about putting black people in jail and taking their votes away. That's what the drug war is about.
Are about you, maintaining would you agree? White privilege.
It's about white privilege, exactly right.
Yeah.
And she shows that white people actually smoke pot generally at a higher percentage rate than black people. But black people are, you know, 80% of the people arrested for pot. I mean, you know.
It's and all the drugs. What has happened, Harvey, is that the... I've been writing about this longer than Michelle Alexander. And the only quarrel I have with her book is that she didn't footnote my earlier writing on this.
Well, they never do. You got, you know, that woe be to the path breaker,
so,
you know.
The way I got into sort of analyzing this, you know, is that there's a very important criminologist named Al Blumstein at Carnegie Mellon. And in 1972, he wrote a very important paper called A Theory of the Stability of Punishment. Sociologists had looked at the question of deviance since the early 20th century and sort of speculated about it and what it meant and how widespread it was. And one of the fathers of sociology, Emil Durkheim, had argued that deviance in a culture is a fairly level, steady kind of a thing. The different things may become deviant, but the need of a society to identify behavior or people as deviant is a very important kind of feature of a culture. And Blumstein looked at punishment. He looked at the rate of incarceration in the United States and compared it to Norway, and found that for a half a century, the rate of incarceration was level. And he argued that maybe it's not deviance per se, but it's the amount of punishment in a society remains level. And so his paper is called The Theory of the Stability of Punishment. And so from 1920 to 1970, he shows that in the United States, the rate of incarceration is level at about 110, 120 per 100,000. Now, the rate of incarceration in the country reflects all the different police departments of the thousands of counties and all the cities and all the thousands of prosecutors' offices and all the thousands of judges in all the 50 states who are imposing punishment. And that from the roaring 20s, alcohol prohibition, through the Depression, through the World War II, through the post-war boom, through the 50s, even through the turbulent 1960s, the rate of incarceration is flat in the United States for this remarkable half century. And so he would, you know, this was a paper that sort of helped make his reputation as one of the most prominent criminologists and was a president of the American Society of Criminology. And in the 1990s, many, many years later, I would hear him speak at conferences. He'd be, you know, the headline criminologist. And he'd put up data that would show the rate of incarceration has skyrocketed. By the 1990s, it was like 600 per 100,000. And he'd put up these slides. And I'd look at them and I heard him speak many times, and I said, what happened in 1970? Why do you have this long historical pattern which changes very dramatically? And what I think, 1970 is essentially the high water mark of the civil rights movement. That by 1970, the punishment of blacks for the status of being black is no longer permissible. cops can't arrest you for being the black kid in the whites only swimming pool. They can't arrest you deny you a job if you're black. You can't be denied education or going to college or university. All of the things that were intrinsic in Jim Crow up until the 1960s, all of that was now eliminated by the civil rights movement. And so the punishment for which was to be black in majority white society, which was Jim Crow, that punishment is no longer available. And so white society needed, in order to maintain white privilege, a new kind of punishment, and that becomes the war on drugs.
Right, but you got to remember, I agree with you entirely, and that Michelle Alexander, you know, follows on your work and makes that a point. You have to remember also, though, that with the Voting Rights Act, black people starting to get the right to vote, right?
That's right.
At 65. And so what the war on drugs does is takes away that right to vote and allows Nixon to do the Southern strategy. You have to remember that some of the states, I think 5, 6, 7 of the states of the former Confederacy had populations about 40% black people.
Right.
And if all those black people turned out to vote Democratic and only got 10 to 20% of the white vote, then the Democrats were going to take over the South again. Or they'll hold the South, but it would be liberal Democrats instead of right-wing Democrats. And so what the war on drugs did was it disenfranchised the black people. And that, so in two ways, it's a response. The drug war is a response to civil rights movement. First, as you say, you can't arrest people for being black, so you got to arrest them now for having drugs, which was nonsense because they didn't have it in any disproportion for white people. But nonetheless, it gave them the Nixon regime the flexibility to arrest black people whenever they wanted. And secondly, having lost that possibility, just for being black. Now they had to have an excuse. But the second and more important thing is that they politically gutted the Voting Rights Act. But the war on drugs is really politically a response to the Voting Rights Act to prevent black people from voting.
I hadn't thought about that particular angle. I see it in sort of, you know, a broader dynamic rather than the particular ambitions of a member of Congress. That the bigger role is that when we think of the drug problem, we think of it as therefore a black problem. That even though most drug users in the country are white, 2/3 of all crack users are white. Almost all the overwhelming majority of those who die from heroin overdoses are white. You know, the whites are tragically victimized by the drug problem. But when white people think about the drug problem, they think it's a black urban problem. And that it plays out in many ways. If I am an employer and a young black person comes applying for a job, then I say, well, I'm going to have to give this person a drug test. I assume that this black person is a drug user, even though the blacks use hard drugs at much lower rates than whites do. The features of Jim Crow, you can't travel. Well, if you're on parole, you can't travel. You're not qualified for certain kinds of jobs. Well, if you have a drug conviction, you're ineligible to get a job where you need a state license of good moral character. Whether it's a barber's license, a plumber's license, all of these licensed professions or trades, you no longer are eligible because you have a drug conviction. With a drug conviction, you're not eligible financial assistance to go to college. So the desegregation of higher education gets reversed. So in public housing, you've got one strike and you're out, you're kicked out of public housing. Grandmas get kicked out of public housing if the kid has a drug, if the grandkid has a drug conviction. But if you're a middle class person who has a government insured mortgage, you don't lose your mortgage because you have a drug conviction. You still stay in your home. So it plays out in race and class bases in so many ways.
Let's remember, we're talking with Eric Sterling here, of the criminal president of the Criminal Justice Foundation, also a commissioner on the what is the formal title of the board you're on in Maryland, Eric?
It is the Natalie M. LaPrade Medical Marijuana Commission. And we're going to be renamed when the governor signs a bill in the next few weeks to the Natalie M. LaPrade Medical Cannabis Commission.
Ah, that's a good idea. Cannabis is...
And I recently heard a man named Mark Kleiman, who has written about marijuana for many years. He was on a panel last week at the Brookings Institution. And he said, I'm not going to be saying anything about marijuana today. And everybody, why, huh? This whole thing. I'm only going to be talking about cannabis. He said, you know, the rest of the world, you know, uses that term. You know, this is a term that was adopted for racist purposes by, you know, the head of the Bureau of Narcotics in the 1930s as a way to demonize cannabis, to give it a different kind of a name. And so lots of us are, you know, now trying to use the medical scientific name cannabis instead of marijuana.
I like that. That's good, actually. I like cannabis. How did the word pot kind of be associated with marijuana or cannabis?
Don't know.
All right, I don't know either. All right, Eric Sterling, very, very interesting. I'm going to remind you, however, on this this strain of the idea that the pot laws, the drug war, was used for political purposes to disenfranchise black people. You need to remember how the 2000 election was decided. You'll remember that Florida had a law in the books saying felons, even who are out of prison, could not vote. And, you know, in an election allegedly decided by less than 600 votes, although we know it was all a scam, that the Jeb Bush, our next president, disenfranchised tens of thousands of black people in Florida on the basis of their having been convicted of a felony. And I guarantee you, you know, the vast majority of those convictions came from the drug law, from the drug laws. And you could almost say it, well, I will say right now, that George W. Bush, among many other ways of his illegitimate presidency, his selection in 2000 was definitely in part a product of the drug war.
Yes, I think that's a very easily proven assertion.
Good. Okay, so now let's get a little more current. Well, not good, actually. What a tragedy! Let's just go bang our heads against the wall in tragic mourning for the horrendous 8 years we had with George W. Bush himself, at very least, a pot smoker. God knows what else he might have done. You know, when I was raising my kids, when they asked me about pot, I'd say, well, I'd show them a clip of George W. Bush and say, like, you want to wind up with him, like him, drink alcohol. But anyway, that's a different story. So we now have Puerto Rico in the camp. How many states have medical marijuana now? Or let's call it medical cannabis.
Right.
How many states have medical cannabis?
There are about 23 states that have what would be considered functional or soon to be functional medical cannabis programs. That is, that there's a would be a mechanism for people to go to doctors. State law would provide that doctors can make recommendations, and that there would be either patients could grow their own, or there would be a way in which patients could legally obtain cannabis based on that doctor's recommendation. There are other states that are called CBD only. They're one of the 80 or so cannabinoids in cannabis is cannabidiol. And that has been, varieties of cannabis or extracts of cannabis that have high concentrations of CBD have been shown to be very effective in dealing with pediatric epilepsies of different kinds. And so some states have passed laws to allow CBD to be made available for pediatric use only. As someone said, what happens when my kid turns 18? Does it start getting, you know, he doesn't get eligible for medicine anymore? You know, but those are obviously, you know, politically determined kinds of choices.
Right. But and I did see another
dozen or so of those states, I believe.
Yeah. Sanjay Gupta ran what I thought was a very good series, actually, on medical cannabis, where he had this child, this young girl who was suffering from epileptic seizures. And
yeah,
nothing would happen.
Charlotte
and then they got the special cannabis from a place in
Colorado.
Yeah. That was a beautiful story, actually. But I guess there's a hitch. When she turns 18, she'll just have to move to Colorado.
She lives in Colorado. Charlotte Figge lives in Colorado.
Well, they moved her there. They were from somewhere else.
Maybe. I don't remember that. I know that there are other children. We have children in Maryland who have moved to Colorado. And it's heartbreaking. You know, I work closely with parents, you know, who every day weigh the question, you know, do I split up the family? You know, we've got jobs here. We've got a house here. Do we, who goes to Colorado? Do we all go to Colorado? Can we go to Colorado? When are we going to get the medicine? How do we get the medicine? It's a heartbreaking situation to be in the middle of.
Completely unnecessary. Completely gratuitous. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so I also saw he had a great show on, I don't know if it was him actually, but it was on CNN. They followed the story of this, these cannabis entrepreneurs who opened a medical outlet, a medical cannabis outlet in Breckenridge, Colorado. And they had to fight the town to stay on Main Street, right in the middle of town. All the other cannabis places were sent out to the airport. And they fought and fought, and then the day came, finally, when they were able, when cannabis was made legal in Colorado. And they were able to, they sold like $25,000 worth of cannabis in a single day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they paid 25% of that to the town. And suddenly the town started to change their mind about having this cannabis place on Main Street that they're trying to get rid of. Suddenly maybe it wasn't such a bad idea to get $6,000 a day in taxes from, you know, one shop on Main Street in Breckenridge.
Right.
So
right.
Now we have how many states now, Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Foundation and president, how many states do we now have pot fully legal?
Four. Two of them have not come online, but it's online certainly in Colorado and Washington State. We have Alaska and Oregon where it's in the process of being implemented. And then we have under the District of Columbia local law, it's legal to possess and grow up to 6 plants in the District of Columbia. And you can give an ounce away legally at no remuneration in the District of Columbia. You can't use it in public. You can't grow it outdoors. You can only grow it indoors in D.C. So it's a very funny kind of law. You can't sell it, and you can't buy it except unless you're a patient with a doctor's card, with a government-issued card in D.C. But that's, you know, and that's going to, in November, in 2016, we're going to see this on the ballot in a number of states, certainly in California, quite possibly in Massachusetts, possibly in Maine or Vermont, Nevada, Arizona. And as you're aware, out in Ohio, possibly in Ohio.
Well, let's talk about Ohio. Now, Ohio's a different story. Very quickly, though, in Maryland and in the other states with medical cannabis, wouldn't it be just cheaper for them to make it totally legal?
Well, patients are aware that there are actually a lot of differences in cannabis, and that different proportions of different cannabinoids can affect different parts of the body. There are two different kinds of cannabinoid receptors. There are cannabinoid receptors that are sort of nervous system related that are in the brain and other parts of the body. And then there are other receptors that affect muscle and immune system and digestion that are throughout the body. And different kinds of phytocannabinoids have tumor-killing qualities. They have muscle relaxing qualities, they have digestive qualities, they have, there are enormous number of features that we really are at the threshold of learning about. And the principal intoxicating cannabinoid is THC, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, and that is not necessarily the cannabinoid that is medically useful in all other cases. So that recreational marijuana, which is very high in THC, may be a splendid intoxicant, but it might not be the best medicine. And so you've got very small markets for certain kinds of cannabinoid preparations or cannabis with certain kinds of cannabinoid profiles that would not be particularly significant in a recreational marketplace. And the other thing is that, we know from, 100 million Americans who've used marijuana since the 1960s, that it is, relatively harmless. But for people who have compromised immune systems and so on, you want the manufacturer of your medical cannabis to be essentially at the pharmaceutical level. It's really got to be, you're preparing it in a way that you're very careful and more careful than you might be if you're preparing it for recreational purposes. And so, there's a lot of concern in Colorado, in Washington, that the quality of the medical cannabis that's available will be undermined as the legal recreational markets dominate the overall cannabis markets.
Very interesting. It is quite amazing the range of products that are associated with cannabis. I mean, I went into a pot shop in L.A., and, you know, they had like 60 different varieties of pot and very specific medical indicators for each one of them. I mean, it's very impressive, actually. I want to note that, by the way, I have a friend who has lung cancer, and part of his they're giving him a very specific kind of chemotherapy, and his prognosis is good, but they're also giving him a cannabis suppository. You know, I had to ask him, well, how do you light up? But but he says the only side effect is that he's stoned all the time.
Now, you know, and so they could also be making, you know, there are a variety of, you know, anti-cancer cannabinoid preparations that don't get people so high. You know, I think everybody who is involved in this work, you know, knows of numerous, you know, clinical reports where someone, you know, is seriously ill. They're using an extract in some form, and, you know, the doctors are amazed at how rapidly the tumors are shrinking and soon disappearing. It's a, you know, the, you know, 15 years from now, people are going to be utterly shocked that, you know, the cannabis as medicine was suppressed for as long as it was, because it will be very much mainstream medicine.
Yeah, but it's astonishing. I'm reminded, and I'm sure you know the story, that Grinspoon, Leonard Grinspoon,
was
a professor at Harvard.
Yes.
And he was a cohort, a contemporary of Tim Leary and Richard Albert, who became Ram Dass. And he was horrified by all the pot that was being smoked. And he took a sabbatical. I met him. I worked with his son at Greenpeace, a wonderful guy. And he took a sabbatical specifically to write a book denouncing marijuana or cannabis and all the dangers, to warn kids of the dangers of cannabis. And halfway through writing the book, he decided it was a miracle drug. And he completely changed his mind and wrote Marijuana Reconsidered, and has been the great medical advocate of cannabis for 40 years now.
Yeah, Lester served as the chair of the board for Normal for a while, and Dr. Grinspoon wrote a book called Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine, that was published by Yale University Press. And I've heard Lester say that it was the most popular book that the Yale University Press ever published.
I bet, yeah. You're right, it's Lester, and it was, what was the title again?
Marijuana, the Forbidden Medicine.
Right, right, right. Well, he came to testify. They brought him in to testify in front of the Ohio legislature, and he might as well have been talking to the pillars in front of the building. I mean, these guys absolutely did not listen. It was grotesque, and they were you know, rude, as a matter of fact. So let's talk about Ohio. I think that Ohio is likely to be the only state in the country with a marijuana cannabis initiative this fall. Yeah, we have a strong off-year election. I don't know. It's off-year, really. They are aiming, the sponsors of this legislation are aiming to have it on the ballot in the fall, and they have a very good chance to get there. And the reason is they've got millions of dollars to spend. Now, Eric, are you familiar with the Ohio initiative?
No. I've only heard sort of stories about it.
Let me fill you in. I'm in the horses whatever here in Ohio, and the fact of the matter is that these wealthy, very wealthy speculators, really is the only thing you could call them, have drafted a referendum, an initiative ballot, an initiative to go on the ballot in 2015 in November, and it says that cannabis will become legal. But it can only be grown, and of course, restricted legality. There are, I think there's a 21-year-old age limit maybe, and the quantity restrictions and things like that. But it can only be grown on 10, for commercial purposes, on 10 designated farms in Ohio. And they are named, and they are all owned by the guys who are promoting the initiative. It's astonishing. I mean, these guys are saying, okay, pot can be legal, but you have to buy it from us. It's devastating. But the bottom line is, for me, is that they are advocating to legalize it. They're spending millions of dollars. They're going to get the signatures. It's been approved by the Attorney General, who's, you know, no liberal, God, Mike DeWine. I mean,
The famous, very important former congressman and senator.
Right, and he's this Attorney General of the state of Ohio now. I mean, he's got to keep working. He's got 11 kids. And so they couldn't – I'm sure he would have loved to have just blown it off the ballot, but they can't. He's approved it. They went through a couple drafts. These guys have apparently bottomless pockets. And the marijuana the cannabis advocacy community, the hardcore, is horrified because this is a corporate takeover of the marijuana trade, of the cannabis market. But on the other hand, you know, they won't be throwing pot smokers in prison for walking around with a joint that they bought from one of the 10 approved farms. But nonetheless, you know, this is an astonishing development. I mean, it's predictable. Of course, the corporations are going to get into it. One of the promoters of the legislation is Oscar Robertson. I don't know if you're a basketball fan. Oscar Robertson is a 6'5" guard from the University of Cincinnati. He went and played for the Cincinnati Royals and then for the Milwaukee Bucks, and he played with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and won an NBA championship. He is one of the backers of this, 10 anointed cannabis-growing, initiatives, this initiative in Ohio. It's an astounding development. I think it's going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
So then what are we looking at? We're looking at the legalization of cannabis with a corporate, this is the General Motors of cannabis here. It's mind-boggling. You need to take a look at this, Eric. I mean, this is an amazing situation.
I will. What it reminds me of is, in some way, thinking about the development of railroads in the last half of the 19th century, in which people sort of figured out there was this new technology called, the railroad and this new industry and, very powerful business interests got the ability to, create railroads in various states. And finally, their political power was then broken, by the progressive era, and under Teddy Roosevelt. And, their ability to set favored rates and so on got broken. And I envision that, these guys may have an opportunity, early on to have this kind of market oligopolistic power, but that, it'll get, as the political outrage develops and says, why are these prices this way? Or why are these guys have these franchises? It may change.
Well, I think my sense is that, I know that people are angered by it, but listen, I know the situation in Ohio. If you don't have millions of dollars, you're not going to get cannabis legalized in this state. My concern is that they'll grow the cannabis and they'll spray it. They'll do agribusiness and it'll be bad corporate farming. That's
what
I'm concerned.
Here's the thing and I see this in Maryland, where we're being asked to issue licenses to produce medical cannabis. And every one of those people who's coming to the commission for a license is asking for a license to commit a federal felony.
that's a small detail, right?
it depends whether you're the U.S. attorney or not, how small a detail it is.
Yeah, right.
And if these guys in Ohio, are selling cannabis that the public thinks is contaminated, if their business practices are unethical, the U.S. attorney can shut them down in a week. And their millions are not going to be able to protect them. You know, they will look like very juicy forfeiture targets for prosecutors who are going to look very, very carefully at how these people operate. This thing is going to continue to change and evolve. And there are very powerful advocates for public health and public safety who don't want to see a large commercialized cannabis industry. And, these guys in Ohio may be the first big defendants.
It's very interesting. Eric, you've been a sterling guest, how we say. Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Foundation. Is that the name of your organization?
It's Criminal Justice Policy Foundation.
Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. You're in D.C. You're on the Maryland Commission looking into medical cannabis. And I've been honored to have you. You're a terrific guest. And we're going to have you back. I mean, there's so much more to talk about. And one point I want to make, we only got 2 minutes very quickly, is that when we're talking about money and cannabis, I think the hemp industry, industrial hemp for clothing, for food, for paper, and from, of course, rope has been around for a long time, is going to be a much bigger industry once it's legalized for consumption and medical purposes. Cannabis for industrial uses and for fuel, biofuels, is going to be way bigger than
I agree with you. The cannabis as an intoxicant is very expensive because it's illegal.
Right.
And the volume, when it's produced in scale, it's going to become very inexpensive.
Right. Eric, give us your contacts, because we're going to have to leave here in a minute.
My website, it's www.cjpf.org.
Eric Sterling at cjpf.org, the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. You've been a terrific guest, and we will have to have you back. But you need to let's talk further about the Schaefer Report. I want to get that out there, and also this amazing development here in Ohio. You need to look into it. And because it's tearing the pot advocates apart, but anything that gets people to stop getting busted for smoking cannabis, for God's sakes, is fine with me. Thank you so much, Eric. Thank you all my listeners and at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you to the great crew in New York. We'll be back again next week with another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Was there an Eve, or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.